Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The year was 2016. The event, the GOP presidential primary season. The topic, the open disdain Republican leaders had for then-candidate Donald Trump. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham said Republicans should, quote, tell Donald Trump to go to hell. Senator Marco Rubio called Trump a, quote, con man and the most vulgar person to ever aspire to the presidency. Senator Ted Cruz later stood on stage and was then booed off that same stage at the Republican National Convention when he told the crowd to, quote, vote your conscience. Utah Congressman Jason Chaffetz reacting to the Access Hollywood tape by saying he couldn't look at his teenage daughter in the eye if he voted for Trump. Well, Tim Miller calls those politicians, and more importantly, the scores of operatives that surround them, the once normal Republicans, the people who were supposed to be the adults in the room. But they were not. They were the sycophants and the yes-men that enabled Trump and paved the way to the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Now, you might think you know the story about why so many formerly, quote, pragmatic and practical Republican leaders so rapidly became ideologues who willingly undermined even their own party's most cherished principles. But you don't know the story from Tim Miller's point of view. Miller was a top GOP operative for many years. He worked for John McCain in 2008, for the Republican National Committee during Romney's run in 2012, and for Jeb Bush in 2016. Miller rejected Trump and led a major anti-Trump super PAC. He was, and still is, deeply connected to party players, including people whose names appear on organizing documents for the January 6th rally, an attack on the Capitol. Tim Miller's new book is called Why We Did It, a travelogue from the Republican road to hell. And it's a deeply personal analysis of what happened to the party he once loved. And he's with us now. Tim Miller, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me, Meghna. And that was some triggering audio clips you played of me earlier from 2012, deep in the archives. I'm still a little shaken by that, but I'm going to do my best to pull it together.
That was Tim Miller of old, and I do apologize for triggering you. But I actually want to go even further back, and I would like to start in a place where you start early on in the book, because I have to say I was quite impressed by how much you put your own self under the microscope here. So let's go back to 2006, and John McCain in one of his runs for presidency, and you're just about to start working for him, and he's doing this town hall with Chris Matthews on Hardball at a campaign stop in Iowa, okay? And John McCain is asked about his stance on gay marriage. And at first, Senator McCain says, well, quote, I think that gay marriage should be allowed if there's a ceremony kind of thing, if you want to call it that. Matthews goes to a commercial break. They come back. He asks McCain something completely unrelated. But then the senator says this.
Could I just mention one other thing? On the issue of the gay marriage, I believe if people want to have private ceremonies, it's fine. I do not believe that gay marriages should be legal.
So, Tim Miller, you write about this moment in the book and about what you were thinking at the time. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, well, I was in the closet at the time, working just down the road in Des Moines for a congressional candidate. But I had already agreed in principle to work for McCain's presidential campaign. I think this was the fall of 2006, and so I was going to join after the November midterm elections. And I remember sitting there and watching this and thinking to myself, oh, man, like, the guy I'm going to work for really just screwed up. And that was my initial instinct. And, you know, then after that kind of wears off, I started thinking to myself, and I think, well, on the other hand, isn't this kind of nice, right? Like, this is a good sign, right? Things are going the right direction. I might work for a person who it would be, you know, willing to support a private ceremony for me and my future husband that I'm not even ready to admit that I want yet because I'm still in the closet. It was just a deep mind mental gymnastics. I was about to use a bad word. It was deeply mental, a lot of mental gymnastics that I was going through. And I give this interview to The Advocate magazine. I end up moving to DC the next year, coming out of the closet. And, you know, in the late 2000s, I was probably, because I was a press spokesman, the most visible openly gay Republican in the country. And so, you know, I would get interview requests and, you know, I'd hear from other people who are struggling through this. And I went back and read the interview that I gave to The Advocate where she asked me, how do you deal with this? And my answer is horrifying, honestly, in retrospect. I basically just said, look, I'm a political operative. My job is to help my candidates win campaigns. You know, if my candidate says something that is going to make them likely to lose the Iowa caucuses, that's a bad thing. Like, even if it's good for me personally. And I wanted to really, and I went back and looked at all my emails from that time and just to like make sure I remembered correctly what was going through in my mind. And I thought, like, this is just such a prime example of the kind of compartmentalization that political operatives go through in order to justify working for people whose values are separate from them. And I wanted to tell the story and be fully honest about it because I think it's an insight as we get move forward into the Trump time. Like, if I could not only justify working for someone that wanted to deny me the most important things in my life now, my husband and my child, how easy would it be for somebody to, you know, justify and rationalize working for someone that isn't going to hurt them at all, right? That might hurt kids at the border or, you know, might hypothetically hurt our democracy, right? And so I think just by exploring and being reflective on my own mental gymnastics and how I was complicit with policies that were actively harmful to me, I thought that was a necessary exercise if I was going to move forward and turn the light on my colleagues who stuck around for Trump.
Yeah, so this idea of compartmentalization is a major thread in your analysis in the book. I mean, because you basically state clearly that one of your big takeaways is that hey, you know, political operatives, they're in it to win it. It's a game, right? And you just want to win that game. And it's like the people that you're writing about, and even you said you yourself, like, didn't necessarily think of politics as this instrument for change in the collective lives of Americans. The reward wasn't supposed to be that. The reward is personal capital and professional advancement, right?
Yeah, and I think this is particularly true in the time and place that we came from. And that's what I want to write about. Look, there have always been hacky political operatives, you know, who care more about winning than losing. But the culture, I think, in the late 90s and the 2000s that kind of led up to Trump, particularly on the right, but a little bit on the left, you know, there's some great books about this. I went back and read Michael Lewis's book from 1996, Losers, about the Dole Clinton campaign. And this was his critique about all of the, you know, he said, everybody I meet on both sides, they only care about their clever tactics and strategies. Like, they don't even seem to have an interest in what the impact is, they're going to have on the voters, which is the whole point of this circus. It's the whole point of why people are running. That's 96. I think it gets worse and worse as you move forward, you know, into 2008. And I think things start to change on the left, particularly with Obama, because he taps into people's, you know, in a very earnest way. I think he inspired a lot of folks. But the that culture continued on the right. And so in Republican politics, we get to this point where the game is the most important thing. And if you're good at it, if you're good at clever attacks, which I was good at that, you know, if you're good at coming up with good strategies for, you know, depressing liberal turnout or riling up the base with red meat, though, that is more important than actually, okay, how are we going to get in office and help people, and improve people's lives, which is the whole point of politics. And it becomes so perverse. It became so perverse that when I went to the Republican National Committee's campaign school, you know, my teacher said, I just really stuck with me. He's like, the best thing that you can be told in politics is that you get it. And what does you get it mean? You get it means that you don't care about all the superfluous stuff, the policies and the white papers. Like, you get the joke. You get that you're here to win. And so to that end, in campaigns, if you are the person who's the turd in the punch bowl, you know, who's saying, I don't know if we should send this tweet. I don't know if we should do this ad. It's too inflammatory. It's not quite true. You become... you become looked at as like you're the problem. You get sent to the back office, right, for questioning, the efficacy and the ethics of campaign tactics, and so, you know, I think this all leads me to Trump. Like, is it that surprising then that somebody like Donald Trump could have manipulated a system that had become as nihilistic and debased as that? Like, I don't think so. With the benefit of hindsight, it makes sense.
Yeah. You know, as I was reading your book, it reminded me a lot of Wall Street pre-2008, yeah. To be perfectly honest, because very few people actually really understood some of the most toxic and complex financial products that they were selling and trading. But, you know, at that point in time, who cared, right? They were making money. They were risking other people's money. So if they lost, no big deal. Except that when they lost big come 2007, 2008, they destroyed actual American families. They took down the American economy. I mean, is it similar?
I do think so. And again, it's similar in the sense that the people that were waving a red flag about that became outcasts, right? Were pushed out, were mocked. I write in the book that I think that there's some differences between, you know, New York and L.A. and D.C. are big striver cities. That New York is really driven by money and L.A. by fame. D.C. is driven by that line from the Hamilton musical, being in the room where it happens, right? This mm-hmm. kind of proximity to power. Some people want to substitute power for that, but that's not really true for most people, because with power comes responsibility. But they want to be close to power. And so that drug of being close to power is very similar to the drug of money. And you get wrapped up in it and you start caring about that more than how your actions are going to impact others. And I think that's an important lesson for how we got here.
Well, we're talking to Tim Miller today. He's a writer at large for The Bulwark now and an analyst for MSNBC and author of the new book, Why We Did It, A Travelogue from the Republican Road to Hell. We'll hear a couple of examples of specific people that Tim talks about in the book when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Tim Miller joins us today. His new book is Why We Did It, A Travelogue from the Republican Road to Hell. Now, Tim, in the book you talk about Reince Priebus, former President Trump's, first chief of staff in the White House. Tell us the story of Priebus sort of before and during the Trump administration.
Yeah, so I got to, Reince was my boss when I worked at the RNC in 2012. So I got to know him pretty well. We worked together then on the famous Republican autopsy that Trump, you know, threw in the trash at Trump Tower and completely rejected all of our suggestions, particularly on the messaging side, the notion that the party should be more welcoming to immigrants and soften, you know, language so it'd be offensive to suburban women. And you know, we move into the primary. Reince stays at the RNC. I go to work for Jeb as his communications director. But we maintained a pretty good relationship. And obviously, all the listeners know what happened there. Jeb didn't do very well in the primary. But we get, as soon as Jeb loses, I join a PAC that was aiming at stopping Trump. And it was really anyone but Trump, whether it be Cruz or Marco or John Kasich. Obviously, I would have preferred Kasich, but any of them I figured would be better than Trump. And so the PAC went after him. And so I was at this debate in Florida after Jeb had lost. And it was the debate where Marco basically just kind of conceded to Trump. He stopped fighting. He stopped doing the hand jokes and just came to terms with the fact that Trump was going to beat him. And after that debate, I saw Reince at a post at a reception for RNC donors. And I pulled him aside. We went out in the hallway and I looked at him and I said, as a friend, I want you to I'm advising you to quit. Because Trump is going to ruin you, and you don't know what bad stuff he's going to do, but you know that he is corrupt. You know that he will say outrageous things. You know he'll say cruel things. And quit now, and just, you know, you don't have to become a never-Trumper, but you can just say Trump deserves his own person here, and you can quit to protect yourself. And he told me at the time, he said, no, Tim, we need to have a good guy in the room when this stuff happens, and if Trump ever goes over the line, I promise you I'll quit. And that's a shortened version of the conversation, but he made that promise to me very, very clearly. And obviously, that was not a promise that he lived up to. He ends up becoming Trump's first chief of staff, and he gets fired by tweet sitting on the tarmac 3 minutes after Trump was on the phone with him and told him that he should come out to play some golf so they can discuss, you know, what the next steps were. He never saw it coming.
Oh, in the book, you write about how Priebus told you that he was so miserable in the White House that he was looking for an exit himself, right?
Yeah, yeah. This was actually during the general election. So Trump hadn't yet won.
In the general,
But yeah, right. So Reince stays, and he's having lunch at this Thai place next to the RNC. And at the time, people might remember if they were paying so close, he kept saying in interviews, I'm not pouring Baileys in my cereal. I'm doing my best to, you know, make this work and herd all the cats and make sure the party has unity. But in private, he was saying that he wished that he could have an exit strategy that would have allowed him to get out. He wanted to have a heart attack, but not a heart attack that was bad enough to have long-term impacts because he had kids. But he was hoping for a heart attack that was just bad enough that would give him cover to quit. But not so bad that it would actually hurt his long-term health. I mean, this is where I just think that it was such a telling example of how these guys are grappling with all this, because it's important. I wonder if this book to be about the people who knew better. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is Reince admitting he knows he's wishing for a heart attack. Like, Trump is so bad, he's wishing for a heart attack. So this is not a person that doesn't know who Trump is, but he still goes into the White House. He still gets drug along. He still sticks around after the Muslim ban. Why? And it was this desire. He just couldn't get it. He just wanted to be in the mix so bad. He just wanted to be in the room where it happened so bad that he couldn't bring himself to quit. He was hoping for a medical intervention to help him do what inside he knew was right. And I just think that's such an important story, because like Steve Bannon is not that interesting, right? Like he's a sociopathic, you know, extremist, right? Like he liked Trump. So those people aren't as interesting to me as the people who knew Trump was bad. They knew so much that they were wishing for a medical event, and yet they stuck with him anyway, and trying to understand why, because that, you know, those are the people that allowed, you know, all of the horrors to go on.
Yeah. Well, so you've given us a couple of reasons that you've concluded why, right? You talked about the compartmentalization. Yeah. You talked about the desire to be in close proximity to power and, you know, the ego inflation that goes along with that. But I also wonder, and specifically because of the fact that that Reince Priebus, as you said, was instrumental in that Republican autopsy from, it feels like, a thousand years ago now, that was, you know, supposedly a party self-analysis about how to make the party more attractive and meaningful in the lives of more Americans, right? It was a document about how to expand Republican appeal to more Americans, that whole big tent talk from a bajillion years ago. But then he goes on to work for the Trump administration. So my question about another reason possibly why is it that for people who so quickly were able to shed beliefs and principles that they were purported to have had, I mean, could it be because they never actually really strongly held those beliefs and principles?
Yeah, I know that's tempting to think. And I think in certain cases, yes, right? Like we talk about this game of politics. I think there were some people around Trump that were never really that ideologically rigid anyway and had kind of, very malleable principles. To me, that would be a more compelling case if we were talking about Ted Cruz winning, right? Like an ideological extremist. Like Trump, the problems with Trump were partly about ideology and policies, but partly about how he was corrupt and manifestly immoral and has all of the seven deadly sins in one person. So that isn't really about ideology as much. You know, it's about making a moral judgment about whether you can go along with this. And so that's why, you know, to me, I felt, okay, you can understand how somebody might sacrifice their view on taxes or climate change or whatever, might agree with that, but I think that you might understand that. How do you sacrifice your policy views and your ethics and your morals and what you think is right? And so I think that is the more interesting question of the Trump era.
Are you still in touch with Reince Priebus?
I haven't heard him since the book came out. So I don't know. Is this a, this is your life? Is this like a Maury Povitz thing where Reince is going to come in and sit on the couch?
Don't worry about that.
I talked to him while writing the book. Yeah. He texted. Okay. We would text. We obviously, he sees me on TV, he watches TV, so he knows what I think. So we don't talk that much. But we talked during the writing of the book because I wanted to make sure I got stuff right. But I haven't heard from him, since.
Because I was going to ask you, what's his answer to the question you just posed about, sacrifice your morals and values? Go ahead.
So his answer is what he told me that night after the debate. We need to have a good guy in the room. And there are a lot of people like this. And I use a different character, Alyssa Farah, as kind of representative of this. Like, we need to have good people here. You remember there was the Committee to Save America, these people that claimed like they had to go into the Trump administration because Trump is so bad that I've got to go take this really high profile job to save America from Trump. But then none of those people supported Joe Biden. I always thought that was kind of weird, the one person that could have actually saved us from Trump. The story Reince tells himself is that it was better him than Bannon. It's better to have somebody like me in there to nudge things the right direction, a good guy in the room. And that never, I just, that didn't work for me. To me, that was a convenient answer that he would tell people like me when he was talking to me. And then I think that when he was talking to pure MAGA folks, he would tell them the opposite, which is that he went in because he thought Donald Trump was much better than Hillary and that, they could install the MAGA agenda. I think that I think he uses compartmentalization. And when Trump did stuff that made him that kind of shook him and concerned him, he justified staying because he's like, well, look, if I leave, who knows who could replace me? Now, to me, this is ridiculous because Reince wasn't stopping anything. Reince is an apple polisher. He does have good tendencies. We all have good and bad inside us. This is another important part of the book. I try to write these people as three-dimensional characters, not just horrible people. But, he has some good instincts, but he was not. This is not the type of person that was saying no, that was putting his finger in the dam. He didn't stop the Muslim ban from happening. It happened on his watch. And so it was just this rationalization that these people used to help themselves sleep at night.
Well, I want to bring in another voice into the conversation, Tim. Let's turn now to Sarah Isger. Right?
Is Your Life.
You knew this was coming, though. Let's be clear. She worked for Ted Cruz, for Mitt Romney, for the National Republican Senatorial Committee, and for the Republican National Committee, and was a top leader in Carly Fiorina's 2016 presidential campaign. And Sarah went on to serve as director of public affairs in the DOJ under Attorney General Jeff Sessions in the Trump administration. She held that position from February 2017 to November 2018, then became senior counsel to the deputy AG, Rod Rosenstein, in December 2018, left the DOJ in 2019. She's now a staff writer at the online magazine The Dispatch. Sarah Isger, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tim. Thanks for the invite.
Hey, Sarah. I wish we could be in the same studio.
Well, we're in the same radio ethereal space, if that'll have to do for today. But Sarah, so like for folks who don't know, can you tell us what animated your decision to join the DOJ under the Trump administration? In its earliest days, and this is especially after Donald Trump as candidate was truly horrible to the candidate you are representing, to Carly Fiorina, who's openly sexist about, you know, a woman ever becoming president. So, but then you went on and worked for him. Tell us why.
Yeah, and I want to be clear. He wasn't just horrible to Carly Fiorina and openly sexist. Obviously, he was. I don't think that's anywhere near the worst part of his candidacy in 2016. And said so publicly many times, said I wasn't voting for him in 2016. Then he wins. And I have worked in all three branches of government. I'd worked at the Department of Justice several times. I've worked in the judiciary. I worked on the Hill. And I love the Department of Justice. And I actually mean that. I love the building, literally. I love the work that the Department of Justice does. The building's gorgeous. If you ever get the chance to visit, the Depression-era art is incredible. And I also know history, and I know the role that the Department of Justice has played in many administrations, the role that Reno played during the Clinton administration, the role, obviously, during the Nixon administration. And so when I got a call, first of all, it was funny. I got a call about a job in the White House, which I was like, well, that doesn't make any sense, and turned down that. It was a very senior job in the White House. And they said, okay, but how about the Department of Justice? And I said, I absolutely agree with like 75% of what Tim has said. And then there's 25% that I think he's missing, which is January 6th and what we know about the run up to that. I know it's fun or funny to talk about, this committee to save America and how they didn't really save America. But maybe they did. You hear a lot about what happened at the Department of Defense and what happened at the Department of Justice and the people who said no. And would you rather that there weren't people there who said no? You know, in the senior staff at DOJ, almost everyone had worked for the Department of Justice before. Rachel Brand had been at the Office of Legal Policy. Rod Rosenstein had been the U.S. Attorney for Maryland during the Obama administration. We all knew what our role was at the Department of Justice, and that almost a check on the president. Now, I've also written about this and said, I've called it the shallow state, the people who knew that Donald Trump had fundamental problems, but who believed that it was important to have good people in government. I don't know that that was right, but I know it's a hard decision, and to make it sound flip, like, oh, that's unprincipled, or it doesn't make any sense because you can't stop everything. Okay, but then tell me who you want in that room instead of Jeff Rosen. Did you want Jeff Clark as Attorney General on January 6th?
Yeah. So, Sarah, if I could just step in here, I'd actually like to refocus on the period well before January 6th, because let's accept Tim's thesis for what it is. He wants to understand. In the book, he's trying to understand the mindset of folks like you and the many others who did work in the Trump administration. So I'd love to hear more specifically about what you were thinking. Let's say even in that first year when you were director of public affairs, so one of the very public faces of the entire Department of Justice. I mean, you had to stand there passionately defend the Muslim ban, Jeff Sessions' child separation.
Well, that's not quite
true. Hang on for a second. So there were policies, though, as public affairs directors that you said, you know, you provided justifications for legal justifications, but Muslim ban, child separation, the crackdown on so-called sanctuary cities. What I'm wondering is, did you personally, agree with those policies? And if not, what was it like for you to then have to stand up and be one of the faces of the DOJ telling the public, this is why we believe these policies are legal?
So I think it's fair for me to get to defend what I did and didn't do. You said I passionately defended the Muslim ban. In fact, I believe the only thing the Department of Justice said was that we were going to file a brief defending the president's constitutional authority to implement whatever that executive order was. And absolutely. And by the way, like, that position won at the Supreme Court, and you want the president to have the full constitutional authority to decide the same way you want Joe Biden to be able to rescind the migrant protection protocols at the border. That's all part of the same idea, right? The president has foreign policy authority in that realm. That's the role of the Department of Justice. And again, many times you will see that, for instance, on the family separation policy, the actual statement I gave was that the policy was in place. It's a factual statement. You know, I think you go back to the role of the Department of Justice in any administration, you have the Obama Department of Justice defending DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. I'm sure that's a policy some of them didn't agree with. So this idea that, like, you always agree with everything a president does policy-wise, I think also isn't the case. But, you know, the majority of my time was spent on the Russia investigation, on Mueller, on protecting that investigation from daily attacks from the White House, from daily attacks from Republicans on the Hill. And I felt like I was in a unique position because I was able to set my career on fire, so to speak. It was fine with me that I was never going to have another job in Republican politics. And I thought that that was important for a person in that role to protect an investigation into a president when no one else around was willing to.
I'm just going to have to take a quick break here. So Sarah Isger and Tim Miller, hang on here for a second. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we're joined by Tim Miller. His new book is Why We Did It, a travelogue from the Republican Road to Hell. Sarah Isger is also with us. She was formerly a director of public affairs in the Justice Department in the early years of the Trump administration. She's now a staff writer at The Dispatch. So, Sarah, I know we've got to let you go in just a minute or two here, but I'm going to have to just circle back to one thing because, you know, you as a lawyer will appreciate this. I didn't actually hear an answer to the question that I believe I posed about did you agree with or believe in the policies that you had to speak about as director of public affairs in the Trump administration, the Muslim ban, the child separation policy, the crackdown on sanctuary cities. I mean, and the reason why I really insist on an answer is because Tim is asking a question of, like, what was going on internally with people that seemed to have led them to compromise their long-cherished principles as mainstream Republicans. And so did you believe in the policies that you had to speak about as a spokesperson for the DOJ or not?
So there are plenty of policies I did agree with that we pursued at the Department of Justice. Remember, the Department of Justice is the one who prosecutes Michael Flynn, Cohen, Manafort, Republican congressmen, the first two, in fact, to endorse Donald Trump, believe it or not. And then there are policies I absolutely didn't agree with. But like I said, first of all, there are policies that people don't agree with all the time in administrations or candidates. I think if the worst thing you can point to in the Donald Trump administration is the Muslim ban, you're missing the forest for the trees here. The worst thing about the Trump administration wasn't policy-based. It was January 6th, and it was an inevitability of something like a January 6th that Donald Trump didn't see himself as an American president, that our experiment of self-government wasn't of interest to him. That's the part where I talk about the shallow state. Maybe we did cause more harm than good. Maybe we obscured the reality of the Trump presidency from the majority of the American people so that 74 million people ended up voting for him. But I think that's hard. Because on the one hand, you obscure it, you make it look like it's functioning, you're pursuing some conservative policies. And on the other hand, you have a president who doesn't relinquish power and there's violence for the first time in an American election. I think that is hard and you have to grapple with it.
Yeah, maybe if you don't mind me just chiming in really quick, just really quick on that, because this was what me and Alyssa Farah in the book go back and forth on quite a bit. And I do fall on the other side of this argument from Sarah and Alyssa, but I don't. Sarah mentioned earlier that it was kind of flip, and I don't mean it to be flip. I guess I do mean it to be flip when I'm talking about somebody who says that they tried to save America and then they voted for Donald Trump from Donald Trump and then they voted for him again. I think that merits mockery, but that is not Sarah, right? She left, opposed him in the reelection. Mm-hmm. Alyssa now says she'll oppose him in 2024. I think these questions are more interesting, right? It's like, for me, I think the reality is that Trump ended up corrupting the people that went in who might have been telling themselves that they were trying to nudge things the right direction. Maybe they did at times, but like over the long haul, you know, they really ended up running cover for him and allowing him the rope to execute what he did on January 6th.
But I think it's interesting to grapple with.
I think it's interesting to grapple with. Yeah.
I think that's a really good point. What if, you know, I saw it as important in my job to protect the Mueller investigation. But maybe it would have been better if President Trump had just fired Mueller and everyone could have seen an American president saying that he would be above the law, that he wouldn't be investigated. I actually do think, looking back, that that is far more difficult a question. You know, we wanted to see the end of the Mueller investigation. Maybe that wasn't the most important thing.
Hmm. You know,
maybe there would have been more votes to convict him. This is what I keep going back to. Would there have been more votes to convict him if people would have seen unadulterated Trump?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Sarah, forgive me, but there's just one thing I can't quite let go of. I agree with you that trying to overthrow a legal election on January 6th, 2021 an unspeakable horror. Okay. So we need to line up together people of all sorts of political beliefs. As long as we believe in the preservation and protection of American democracy, yes, we are in that fight together. I completely agree with you on that. But I don't think that means that some of the other policies that came out of the Trump administration weren't also bad. And I'm going to just drive at this one
they
more
were.
Time.
You mean, great. But yes, you I had, agree. You had, but you I've had, agreed. You, I've agreed several times. I agree. There were bad policies. I did not support the family separation policy. I worked on the EO, in fact, to get it rescinded. Yes. Is that? I feel like I've answered your question and you're saying I'm not. So I'm trying very hard.
Well, because I have never been in your position. I am fortunate enough to not have ever had a job where I wasn't doing what I didn't believe in. So I'm just still trying to understand as deeply as I can what allowed you to persist in what seemed to be something that could have caused you moral injury for so long.
Because again, the thing that I spent time on was making sure the Mueller investigation got to completion. That was the vast, vast majority of my time. I thought it was very important that the Department of Justice be able to complete an investigation into a sitting U.S. president as to whether he had committed any crimes in getting elected to that job. I think looking back that perhaps it would have been better if we had simply let the White House do what they want and fire Mueller. As Tim said, maybe there would have been more votes to convict, but regardless, the American people would have seen what they were dealing with. I think that's the part that I feel like obscured Trump from the American people. The times where Trump was showing the American people who he was, that's democracy, right? Like, that's why we have people vote. But that's the hard part for me in this idea of good people going into government to serve someone who they think is flawed or worse as a president. Nobody is going to agree with everything they work on in these jobs. That's campaigns. That's politics. If you want to agree with 100%, you need to run yourself. Tim and I obviously didn't do that. So, and again, I go back to the Obama administration working on Defense of Marriage Act. Lots of people work on things they don't agree with all the time, and especially at the Department of Justice when you're on the legal side or in the judiciary when you're clerking for a judge, you write opinions that you don't agree with. That's part of the role and the duty of being a taxpayer-funded government job.
Well, Sarah Isger, now with the Dispatch, I know I've kept you longer than you were able to stay with us. So thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that what Sarah's talking about, this is basically the second half of the book, why we did it. It's trying to get at that question you kept asking Sarah. And I asked dozens of people this. I only interviewed people who were like, well, in some ways they're like Sarah in the ways they're conflicted. In other ways, they're different. I think that there were certain people, Alyssa is the main example in the book, that were honestly trying to grapple with this question. And in my view, I come down on the other side. I just don't think that it was worth sacrificing your views on these issues as she just laid out in order to try to nudge things the right direction one way or the other. I think that unfortunately that we were in a position where a bad person had been elected and we had to reap the consequences of that, not cover for him like he was a toddler. There are a whole range of other people that I talk about in the book who give much less morally gray answers than what Sarah just gave. Just pure nihilism, pure focus on the game of politics. Sean Spicer literally says, it's like, lawyers defend bad people. I do whatever I want. Like, this was all part of the rising up the ranks. And so there were it was I think an interesting exploration that I kind of, and I divide all of the different people into different kind of categories about how they did it. And some were actually grappling with it like Sarah is. And in my opinion, ended up in the wrong place. Others like barely grappled with it at all. And I think, that gets back to like the banality of evil, Hannah Arendt type of stuff.
I really, I do understand the belief that it's better to have good people in the room than not. I understand how that is a motivating factor, but it's complicated by what you said earlier, Tim, this desire for the proximity to power. And so, again, that's why it may, like, just on a person-to-person basis, everyone has a line that, okay, they reach a line, they can't cross it. But for some people, perhaps more disturbing, for some people that you knew for years as sort of stalwart, mainstream, principled Republican, it seems that they never reached the line, right? We should talk about that too. Caroline Wren is the one that pops to mind. So tell us about your relationship.
And just really quick with Caroline Wren, before Caroline Wren, just closing the loop on the last thing, the line for me also was opposing Donald Trump, right? Like, this is where their arguments become so weak, not Sarah because she left, but the people who stayed and who didn't step out. Like, there were people, Olivia Troy, Miles Taylor, Elizabeth Newt Luman, who left the White House and said, we need to vote for Joe Biden because this was an insane person, right? And so it's like, I stayed as long as I could, and then I hit a red line and now we need to stop him. All these other folks didn't, which to me shows that they wanted to be close to power more than, you know, than they actually wanted to nudge things the right direction. That was just how they justified it. Caroline Wren is a more extreme example.
Just a second. So just to be clear, because that's a really important point you made. There's, you know, the folks that that never went into the Trump administration. There's the folks that went in, but then they went out, as to be clear, as you said, chose to speak out. Right.
Yes.
And to say, here is, we are taking the risk of losing that political capital, that personal proximity to power in Washington. And we're going to say, here's why we think what the Trump administration is doing is wrong. And then there's all the other people who may have left, but didn't say anything at all. Those are the folks that you're saying, like, what
exactly
is going on?
They're still getting consulting contracts. They still wanted their access. They still wanted to be in the mix, right? And so they're like, they're saying to their friends at the bar, oh, man, Trump's crazy. And they're saying to me on the phone. And I said, okay, well, why don't you say something? Why don't you do an interview? Why don't you help our effort to elect Joe Biden? That became too far. And to me, that revealed that they actually weren't there because they wanted to nudge things the right direction. Maybe that was part of it, but they were there because they still wanted their career. They still wanted access. They still wanted to be close to power. And it was revealed when it hit that question of, will you take this risk of your career of supporting Joe Biden? So few people did that. Anyway, on Caroline Wren, she was my good friend, very good friend, moderate Republican, worked for moderate Republicans. Just to validate that I'm not just snowed by her, this is a woman who flew to Germany on her own dime, to help the refugees during the Syrian refugee crisis who are coming to the train stations because she was so moved by their plight. She gets sucked into Trump orbit kind of by accident. She's working on the RNC convention. She didn't know who'd win. Trump ends up winning. So she's sort of working for Trump by proxy. And because Trump had so few good people around, she gets kind of sucked into maybe not the inner circle, but pretty close to the inner circle. And was close with Don Jr. and Caroline and Kimberly Guilfoyle. This all makes me sick just to even say. Like, I couldn't even imagine being in a room with Don Jr. But anyway, it becomes intoxicating. And so we lose touch, you know, despite having, you know, a very personal friendship. And so I called her before I wrote the book, and I said, I want to understand how you got that far, and to your, as you said in the intro, she ends up on the permit for the January 6th rally as like an organizer. And I said, I need to understand, did I misjudge you? How did this happen? And so we went and met, and we drank for like 7 hours. And so in order to try to get the truth, it was all on the record. And you know, we kind of went through our lives, and I tried to understand how someone who like agreed with me and was a very moderate Republican could have ended up at there on the mall at January 6th.
And
what I found was pretty sad and disturbing. And on the one hand, she gets sucked up by the cult of Trump. You get on the inside bubble and a team. This is an element we haven't talked about yet. Putting on your team jersey, the tribe, you know, you get in a bunker mode is the phrase that we use in politics. So everyone who criticizes you, you get mad at them. And this grievance builds up. You know, you said the media is being mean to my boss. All my friends are, you know, I'm losing friendships. People are saying that I'm complicit in racist stuff. And you build this anger inside you. And so after many hours of drinking, it finally kind of just blurted out of her. And she starts saying to me, I'm just so sick of these liberals and their Priuses and their coexist stickers and drinking out of their plastic straw or their paper straws. Like, that's going to save America. I don't know. She didn't say listening to NPR, but she might as well have. And I was like, what are you talking about? I said, okay, I don't like a paper straw either. I like a chocolate shake with a straw that works. But like that, but working for Donald Trump, trying to do a coup because of that, like, this is crazy. But it was, you know, in short, I know it's a very long conversation. People can read if they want, but the short of it is that you get so wrapped up in this in this our tribal politics and you know, and wanting to protect the people around you that she became deranged and not seeing things clearly and began to hate her fellow Americans more than she, you know, than the good side of her, the caring side that went to Germany got kind of overwhelmed by her grievance towards people that she felt had been hard to her. And I tried to break her. I felt like I came close. People can read for themselves how that shook out.
Well, you know, Tim, look, I just want to reiterate something. I, by no means am I ever going to say that every Democratic politician or operative is some kind of like saint committing their lives for the greater good, right? Like I do maintain a deep skepticism to anybody who is attracted by that tractor beam of political power. But you know, right now we're looking down the pike at 2024, right? And so what lessons do you have for us all about, you know, we might be replaying all of this over again in just a, you know, a year and a half from now. Yeah. So, yeah, what do you think?
It's very disturbing. Just really quick on the Democratic thing. I did a podcast with James Carville where he said a lot of the, you know, he said there's some, obviously some very differences in the level of earnestness on the Democratic side, but some of this just attraction to the game, you know, really resonated with him. I thought that was, I liked to hear that, you know, since I was didn't come from Democratic politics. I didn't like to hear that, but you know, that is universal. Our lesson for 2024 is that we have to tell ourselves stories that are true, and you can nudge people who are getting closer to Trump by listening to Alyssa Farah and welcoming them out. You know, and saying, this is too dangerous. It is not worth it. There are red lines. You can live within your integrity. I'm trying to do that. And it's worked out much better for me than the prior path.
Well, Tim Miller's book is Why We Did It, a travelogue from the Republican road to hell. And it is a fascinating and at times really funny read, I have to say, but well worth your time. So definitely check it out. Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Appreciate you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits, so you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation, and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.